Okay, welcome. Just let me, for those who weren't in Thornhill over Shabbos, which I think is most people here, it's a pleasure to introduce Rabbi Dr. Aaron Adler, who just celebrated his 40th year of Aliyah. 1979 made Aliyah, and really it's, I think, a very successful Aliyah from what we hear about everything, and really it was a... Rabbi Adler grew up in New York, attended Yeshiva University, was the shamus of Rav Soloveitchik, and spoke very close personal relationship with the Rav, served as a rabbi in the States for a couple of years, and then moved to Israel in 1979, served as a Rav in Be'er Sheva for 7 years, moved to Yerushalayim, was a Rav in Ramot for many years, and for the last 10 years has been rabbi in Katamon, and Ol Nechama in Katamon. He's the founding Rosh Yeshiva of the Yeshiva Bnei Akiva Ner Tamid in Chashmonaim, and really one of the leaders in the Anglo community and the Israeli community. He said almost all the shiurim he gives in Hebrew in Israel are bivrit, so he's really made a real impact among Israelis and Americans. It's really an honor and a pleasure to have him. As you know, he's speaking on Rav Aaron Cutler and Dov Revel, both of whom yahrzeits were on Shabbat 22 years apart, 1940 and 1962. But what I didn't know until that Suda Shlishit, and when Rabbi Adler spoke on birthdays in Halakha, Beit Kislev was also his birthday. So I want to wish him a happy birthday, and with that, introduce him to speak. Bakasha. Thank you.
You know what, I have handouts, and they don't have to worry about the Hebrew. I'll translate. Yeah, at least it's something. Let's say, hold it. I'll take one for myself, and the rest can go.
Okay.
Shavua Tov. Thank you very much, Rabbi Kelman. Indeed, today was the second of Kislev, and I always knew it was my birthday, although my family in the States celebrated it on November 19th, but we moved to the Hebrew birthday in our family many, many years ago, so now we only observe the Hebrew birthdays by us. Although I do recognize that once every 19 years, I get a reminder of what my English birthday should be. Sometimes it's a day off, but that's a calendar issue. But Bet Kislev became more significant in my life when I was 10 years old, and I was at the Yeshiva Torah Emes in Borough Park. We had just moved from Washington Heights to Borough Park, and that November, and the secular date was yesterday's date, November 29th, 57 years ago, we heard of the passing of Rav Aaron Cutler. The principal of the yeshiva, Rabbi Elias Schwartz, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, a principal who we all adored and loved, he took the whole yeshiva to the Levaya. And that was on the Lower East Side in New York City, Manhattan. A levaya that had thousands of people. We couldn't even get close to the shul, the Pike Street Shul that was known as by the locals. And we were outside, there was police barricades, and there were bullhorns, you know, microphones outside. So we heard the hespedim. I think everything was in Yiddish, but I understood Yiddish. The very, very fact that we were there as kids, it made an indelible impression. Because I didn't know Rav Aaron Cutler personally. I knew of him. We already knew that there was a thing called Gedolim, Gedolei Yisrael, Torah giants, Torah luminaries. And the two names that were first and foremost in the yeshiva world of Agudat Yisrael were Rav Aaron Cutler and Rav Moshe Feinstein. People were consoled by the fact that there was still a Rav Moshe Feinstein. after Rav Aaron passed away in 1962. And there is an interesting tidbit of biography. Rav Aaron Kotler was born in Lita, but in a place that today is Belarus. He was seen to be a genius early in life. He ends up marrying the daughter of a very, very famous Rosh Yeshiva, Rav Issa Zalman Meltzer, who was the Rosh Yeshiva of the Eitz Chaim Yeshiva that was located first in Slutsk and then relocated to Kletsk. These are names that sometimes the yeshivas are known by these names. So he ends his career, if you may, in Lita as World War II breaks out, not in the town of Kletsk, but what happened in 1940 with the advance of German forces to the in the east, Eastern Front, is the Lithuanian yeshivas all fled to Vilna. And the reason that that happened was Vilna was a little bit of a safe haven, a temporary safe haven, but they didn't know it was only a temporary safe haven. It was caught in the crossfire, political crossfire, between Russia and Germany. And at the moment, enjoyed some type of independence. Limited, albeit, but nevertheless, it allowed the Lithuanian yeshivas to make it to Vilna and survive there. By orders of the Lithuanian authorities, they didn't want the yeshivas to be in the city of Vilna, so they all found places out in the forest, we'll use the word suburbs, that's not a great word in this context, in the forest to set up their yeshivas. And the Rosh Yeshivas actually thought that this wasn't a curse, but it was a blessing, because they didn't want the students to be caught up in a big city, you know, traffic, and I'm not talking about traffic jam, but big city life, too many distractions. They liked the idea of being out in the boondocks, out in the rural areas, and this is where the yeshivas began to function. I would dare say they didn't flourish, but they functioned on some level. Another Rosh Yeshiva came from the area of Belarus today, which is known as Baranovich, and his name was Rabbi Chanan Wasserman, Hashem Yikom Damo. And he ends up in Vilna as well, and then ends up in Kovna, and other yeshivot. This is the story, and it's a story in itself, which we're not going to tell the whole story now, of the students of Mir Yeshiva that ended up from Mir, which is not far from Baranovich in South Belarus today. They also ended up in Vilna. The transport, the movement of the Mir Yeshiva and their families from Vilna to Japan and then ultimately Shanghai in China. There is a Japanese diplomat, Sugihara, who has a special place reserved for him in Olam Haba. There's no question in my mind. The man saved 6,500 Jews because he defied orders and paid for it royally, professionally, after the war. It took years for the Japanese government to finally declare Sugihara as a hero in what he did. But he lived out his life just as somebody who was thrown out of the foreign service because he defied orders. And he did it because he was principled and he saw he had an opportunity of saving Jews. This particular movement from Vilna to via Soviet Russia at the time and getting them to Japan on temporary transit visas and then Japan sending them to Shanghai, this was all a prelude that was supposed to be a continued transport to somewhere where they could be free. But what happened was Japan joined the war after Pearl Harbor, and there was no way that Japan is going to cooperate with American authorities in sending Yeshiva Baruchim over to San Francisco at the time. So they were stuck until 1946. I say 6,500. It's a very, very big number, but it could have been larger. It could have been larger because Sugihara secured 7,500 visas. 1,000 visas went unused. Why? There's a very, very fine book written by Dr. Esther Farbstein. She teaches at the Michlala. She's a daughter-in-law of a very famous Rosh Yeshiva from the Chevron Yeshiva. She's an expert on Holocaust studies, and she specifically deals with the issue of the reaction of the religious and ultra-Orthodox, what we call the Haredi world, to the pre-Shoah days, the Shoah, the Holocaust days, and the post. And there are very, very difficult moments that we have to grapple with upon whether the decisions that were taken were correct decisions or not. In retrospect, we can honestly say that some of the Gedolei Yisrael made colossal, fatal mistakes. But when they took those decisions, they had a basis of deciding the way they decided. And obviously, at that moment, it was in the best interest. It just unfortunately didn't turn out as some of them had thought it would. One of the greatest poskei halakha, halachic decisors, of the first half of the 20th century, Rav Chaim Oizef Grudzinski, no doubt the acclaimed posek of the generation, was against this transportation to Shanghai. And those who listened to him, unfortunately, remained in Vilna to be overrun by the Nazis and never lived to see the day to talk about it. Others defied Reb Chaim Oizer's opinion and felt they're going to do it on their own. Reb Chaim Oizer is not the only one who took such decisions. There were great Hasidic rebbes in Poland who equally advised their own Hasidim to stay put and not try to get to America or to Eretz Yisrael at the time. And al eila ani bochia, on this I cry today. I really, really cry. Because we lost many, many people because they simply relied upon the wisdom, and there was a concept at the time that had been developed by the Chofetz Chaim, who died in 1933, and one of his students, Rabbi Chanan Wasserman, who also studied by Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, our Rebbe's grandfather in Brisk, Da'at Torah, or Da'as Torah, as they call it. And that is, if you are an absolute Talmud Chacham, then you know something about the weather. You can tell me if my plane's going to leave tomorrow or not. Our Rebbe Rav Soloveitchik did not believe in Da'as Torah. He didn't believe in it. He thought that if you want to know something about the weather, go to the weatherman. And if you want to know something about geopolitical situations, talk to a political scientist. The fact that you can explain a difficulty in the Rambam or in a Tosfot doesn't give you a qualitative edge in understanding the political situation. So, but this was the reality, and Esther Farbstein writes about these realities, and we have to understand it and even respect it as we cry over the results. Rav Aaron Kotler was caught up in this web as well, and publicly he never endorsed the movement to Shanghai. He never came out against it, but he did not endorse it either. And many of his students understood the concept of Shev Va'al Ta'aseh Adif. If you don't know what to do, so sit tight, and that's the preferred option. And those who opted to sit tight unfortunately perished. Rav Aaron makes it to Japan. And that's also a situation where if you didn't think that it was all that positive, but at that point it became obvious that his life was in jeopardy as well, and he felt it, and it was too late perhaps for others. The reason why Sugihara's 1,000 visas were not used, because he didn't have takers. There were people there who could have gone, but they didn't go. And it's very, very sad. And many, many of the students of the Kletzky Yeshiva perish with the overrun of Vilna in 1940 and 41. Rav Aaron makes it to the United States, but actually, he makes it to Eretz Yisrael first. And when he gets to Eretz Yisrael, he's in a quandary. His father-in-law, Rav Issa Zalman Meltzer, has already gone to Eretz Yisrael and founded the Eitz Chaim Yeshiva on Yafo Street, next to the Machne Yehuda Shuk. Everybody knows the place. It's like downtown Yerushalayim. Can't miss it. Big yeshiva. And Rav Aaron Kotler is offered by his father-in-law literally to be the successor. I mean, Rav Issa Zalman Meltzer was aging, and there'll be a day he's going to become the Rosh Yeshiva. And Rav Aaron Kotler wasn't sure whether he should stay in Eretz Yisrael or perhaps go to America and try to rehabilitate the world of Torah. What was first and foremost in his mind was the destruction of the world of Torah that he saw so perfectly clear in his mind, and he saw it being destroyed, and he wanted to have a part of rehabilitation of Torah. And the only question was, would it be advantageous for him to do it in Eretz Israel when there were already others doing it, or go to America where it was fertile territory? Because you did not have a full-blown yeshiva the way he understood it in 1941, 42, 43. It didn't exist yet. And he does what's called a Goral Hagra. Goral Hagra is a technique by taking a Tanakh and opening it up randomly several times, and it's a Kabbalistic idea. And then you just take a look at the page that it ends up, and you might see some indication of what to do. It's like God is gonna, it's a Urim V'Tumim type of thing. You laugh. Rav Aaron Kotler did this. And it opens up to Parshat Shmot. And what does it say there? On the page, it says that God spoke to Aaron. Aaron, Moshe Rabbeinu's brother in Mitzrayim. Vaydaber Hashem el Aaron, lech el likrat Moshe Hamidbara. Go towards your brother Moshe in the desert. Aaron hasn't seen his brother for years. Aaron was in Mitzrayim. Moshe was in Midian, marries Tzipora, has a family. Moshe's 80 years old. And there's going to be a family reunion now. And a Kadosh Baruch Hu, God tells Aaron, go to the desert to meet your brother Moshe. Lech likrat Moshe Hamidbara. The address is Aaron, by Daber Hashem el Aaron. And Rav Aaron Kotler is looking at this pasuk, staring at it, and God is talking to him. Go to the desert. The desert is Chutz La'aretz. It's the desolation. And meet up with Moshe. And that was Rav Moshe Feinstein. That's where you're to be. And he does it. And he does it. He gets to the United States. And although he temporarily lived in what was known as the Upper West Side, then moves to Borough Park, he has this grand idea that he's going to build a yeshiva not in the city, because in the city there are distractions. And through the assistance of acquaintances and some financial helpers, he is able to secure a plot of land in Lakewood, New Jersey. And he builds the Kletzk Yeshiva in Lakewood, New Jersey. The official name of the yeshiva is Kletzk, but nobody knows that. It's called Lakewood. You go study in Lakewood. And now there's actually a branch of Lakewood in Ramot Dalid in Yerushalayim, and it's called Lakewood East. That's what it's called, Lakewood East. So there's Lakewood. And Rav Aaron Kotler, his idea was that the way to rehabilitate Torah and to do it as efficiently and as quickly as necessary is to have no distractions at all. And no distractions means no secular studies, no involvement in business. You sit and study Torah. And he felt that if he would have a core of 10, 50, 100, 200, 1,000, such B'nai Torah, the world of Torah would stand up once again. That was his idea. And it would be modeled exactly the way the yeshiva functioned in good old Kletzk and Slutsk. And these are all yeshivot that followed the pattern of Volozhin. And Volozhin Yeshiva was developed by the students of the Vilna Gaon. Vilna Gaon dies in 1796. 5 years later, the Vilna Gaon's prime student, Rabbi Chaim, who's known as Rabbi Chaim from Volozhin, the author of the Nefesh HaChaim, founds the Volozhin Yeshiva. And that's like the mother of the Lithuanian yeshivot. They all stem from the Volozhin. And according to Rabbi Aaron Kotler, we can do it once again on American soil. When Rav Aaron passes away in the early 1960s, there were 250 Bacharim learning in the yeshiva at the time. The idea was they'll get married. They'll marry girls with PhDs. PhD is Papa has dough. And the fathers-in-law will be their prime supporters. If they're lucky, maybe their fathers will also support them. And this now became a way to exist, a legitimate way to exist. Now, did this exist in the history of Am Yisrael, that a person growing up and dedicates his life to study of Torah and hopes that somebody else is going to support him? It existed on very, very limited basis for very, very special top students who were known to be already geniuses in their youth. It never was a type of popular call. They never had that. In Eastern Europe, until World War I, somebody was 13 years old. He most probably went to Cheder. He most probably studied Chumash and Rashi, some Mishnayot, perhaps a basic exposure to Gemara, and now he's bar mitzvah, and he goes out to work. A handful, I'm not sure it's 5%, continued regular Torah study. This what you have in the United States since World War II, and the aftermath of World War II, that people continue learning is a result of the fact that in the United States, 13-year-olds don't go to work, but they continue their schooling at least until 18. And now with college education in many, many circles as being almost a minimum type of education. So Rav Aaron felt he could have the yeshiva bachrim also continue in this way. But it wouldn't stop at age 22 or 24 or 30. Some fellas are on the 20-year plan when they get married. And these things become negotiated with the new family. Shidduchim are made or busted on these negotiations. And you might say, one second, there's a girl involved. There are feelings. Should there not be feelings? That's a shiur in itself about the world of Shidduchim that is somehow brought together with a lot of financial strings attached to it. No different than political marriages. Shlomo Melech had 700 wives. He had 300 concubines, pilakshim. Chazal never attacked him for the 700 wives. Why? These were political marriages. Shlomo Melech married the daughter of every general in the neighborhood. And that's how he protected the peace. Because you don't start up with your son-in-law. Sometimes you do. But they were all mishpacha. It was one happy family. He married the daughter of every king in the neighborhood. So he had all these wives. See, these aren't romantical type of relationships. These were political marriages. And we know in the history of monarchies, there are political marriages. So here, there were financial marriages. And we know that there are financial marriages too. Some succeed in becoming very, very warm, loving relationships. And some don't. But you have the same situation, even if it's not a marriage based on financial consideration. This is Rav Aaron Kotler, and in his capacity as Rosh Hashiva of Lakewood, he also becomes a Posek Halacha. And this is something important. This year, in the magazine called Tradition of the Rabbinical Council of America, they're going to be observing 25 years of the article written by Rav Professor Chaim Soloveitchik, that's the Rav's son, called Rupture and Reconstruction. I have never seen an article that was written in Tradition where years later they're coming back to it and celebrating it and having people write articles about it. It was a tremendous hit, 1992. And Rav Chaim Soloveitchik there, who is a historian, talks about the fact that up until World War I, the champions of Torah were the city rabbis, the town rabbis. They were the ones who were in contact with the people. They knew what was going on the ground in terms of the custom. Obviously, they knew the halakha too very well, but they always, always took into consideration that which the people were doing. That became very important and sometimes would override the understanding of the sources. Whereas in the yeshiva world, from the days of Volozhin, they were spiritual cocoons, cocoons. They were separated, segregated from the communities. So much so that when the yeshiva bachrim of Eastern Europe would go to the Balabatim for a Shabbos meal, and especially if the Balabatim had daughters, they wanted the yeshiva boys to come over and maybe get something started there. Boys were instructed not to talk halacha with the host family. You can say a Dvar Torah. Yeah, you can say about Parshat HaShavua, yes. But don't talk halacha, because there's a rav in town. And the Rosh Yeshiva respected the autonomy of the town rabbi for halacha. The Rosh Yeshivas were there doing their thing, explaining the theory of Gemara, but not bringing it down to practice. But as Rav Chaim Soloveitchik pointed out, the communities collapsed, beginning with World War I, and were completely destroyed after World War II. And Torah survives through yeshivas. The Chofetz Chaim, the Mishnah Berurah, he was not the Rav in Radin, he was the Rosh Yeshiva in Radin. Rav Moshe Feinstein was a Rosh Yeshiva. Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach in Yerushalayim was a Rosh Yeshiva. Rav Aaron Kotler was a Rosh Yeshiva. They were not Rabbonim of towns, they were Rosh Yeshiva. And Rosh Yeshiva, many times, based their halacha upon the way they understand the sources. And they're not terribly concerned about what's going on out there by the people. And if they feel that their conclusions are different than what's going on by the people, let's get out there before Shabbos Shuvah and talk about it so people should change their ways. That became more and more acceptable way of rabbinating. Our Rebbe Rav Soloveitchik was very different, because in Boston he was a town rav, and in YU he was a Rosh Yeshiva. So he was wearing two hats. And he was able to fluctuate and oscillate between these two types of worlds. And it is possible. And many, many Rabbonim from our yeshiva who've become Rabbonim and Rosh Yeshiva. I mean, I'll take my brother in Teaneck, Rabbi Yosef Adler, as just a good example. But there are many other examples of people who are fine Rosh Yeshiva and community Rabbonim and are able to work it out, the two different styles. So when I walked in, I saw right away here in the Beit Midrash two volumes called Mishnat Rabbi Aaron. I just found it right now. And this is a sefer that was published by the Lakewood Yeshiva of responsa literature of Rav Aaron Kotler. I said, wow, this is great. I didn't know this was here, because I flipped through quickly the index and I said, oh, I hope they have something on gelatin. Because when I grew up in the United States, gelatin was chazer, was the avi avot of treif. And we couldn't eat this ice cream and we couldn't eat these confectionery products because they had gelatin. And gelatin is a byproduct of bones that many times came from pigs. And the bones were ground into, and the processed, and now it became gelatin. And gelatin is a stabilizer. And they use it in puddings, and they use it in yogurts, and all kinds of things. Because if you have a flavored yogurt, so you don't want all the strawberries to drop to the bottom. You want them to float as you open it up. I mean, what's the big deal of taking the spoon and, you know, mishing up the yogurt a few times? Sometimes you do it anyway. But do you ever notice that the strawberries or the blueberries, they're floating? How do they do that? It's called a stabilizer. It's a gore miyatsev in Hebrew. And gelatin is a very, very good agent for it. Well, it comes from pigs. And if most of the gelatin produced in the United States comes from a non-kosher animal and is now used in modern food production, can you eat those products, food products? Well, we grew up, of course not. It's gelatin. And you heard the word gelatin, it was synonymous of chazer. It was pork. You can't do that. Well, years later, we discovered that there was a big machloket about this. And none other than the Rav's grandfather, Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, that's already the great-grandfather of Professor Chaim Soloveitchik. Rav Chaim Soloveitchik from Brisk, he said that gelatin from a non-kosher animal is glatt kosher. Not just kosher. It's perfectly okay. Why? Because of a concept called shinui. Shinui means something took a it morphed into something else. There was a transformation, and it's no longer, it loses the original identity. And hence Rav Chaim said that that product that we call today gelatin is no longer part of what once upon a time was a non-kosher animal. Similar, by the way, to Rav Moshe Feinstein's psak, that when you have enzymes, vitamins are enzymes. When you have vitamins that come from liver, sometimes people are told to take vitamins that have heavy liver extract. So those vitamins, Rav Moshe Feinstein said, are not fleshiks, they're not besari, they're parf. Because of the same reason, they've been reprocessed. So you have the concept of shinui that kicks in. Now, in the United States, Rav Aaron Kotler's very, very strong opinion, and I see the tshuva, the responsum, is almost 20 pages long. So he's making a strong case for something that I guess he realized wasn't so simple, that it's not kosher. So he wants to make it very, very clear that it's not kosher from every angle. And this is adopted by kashrus agencies like the OU and every kosher agency in North America. And then you go in Aliyah, and you know, you don't know anything about the hashgachot. So the worst thing to do is, you know, call your cousin and don't eat this hashgacha and don't eat that hashgacha. Well, you start reading the labels, and it says kasher le'ochlei gelatin. It's kosher for those who eat gelatin. What? It's kosher for those who eat gelatin? Gelatin is treif. Well, it's not treif. The Rabbanut in Eretz Yisrael adopted the viewpoint of Reb Chaim Soloveitchik that gelatin is not treif. What happened was the companies decided to give the consumer a choice. The Rabbanut will give the hashgacha, and they will indicate that if you do not eat gelatin, if that's your custom, don't eat this product. So now it's on the label. If it is with marshmallows, for example. So if it's mahadrin marshmallow, then it does not have gelatin from a non-kosher source. The gelatin comes from fish. They produce it in Belgium. It's fish gelatin or a vegetable product called agar, A-G-A-R, which I remember Rav Aaron Soloveitchik, the Rav's younger brother, had that in the ingredient for Pesach Kogel. When Kogel had hashgacha for Pesach, so it said on it, it had agar. It was a vegetable type of byproduct that served as a stabilizer. But it wasn't the gelatin that Rav Aaron Kotler was talking about. So this was an issue that Rav Aaron Kotler took a stand. He took a very, very firm stand. And to a certain degree, it succeeded in America. It became accepted. It became mainstream. This was Rav Aaron as a Rosh Hashiva. So I said he died in 62 with, in 1962, Tavshin Chav Gimel it was already, with 250 Talmidim in Lakewood. How many Talmidim are in Lakewood today? 6,500 study in Lakewood today. So this really took off. Now, it's very similar to the development of the Mir Yeshiva in Yerushalayim. Anybody take a guess how many people studied in Mir, in Belarus? In its heyday, it didn't have more than 150 Talmidim, maybe 200 Talmidim, maybe. Now there are 7,500 Talmidim studying at the Mir. And it's just become a place to take a shtenda. You don't even have to register. You don't have to go to a shir. You just have to sit there and, you know, convince your father-in-law that you're finishing shas and you're going to put out a sefer and he's going to pay for it. This is what you have. I remember before we came in Aliyah, so Lakewood then still was small numbers, was about 350 Talmidim. And my wife had a first cousin who I knew years ago. I went to first grade with him. And he was in Lakewood. And I told him that I heard that a third of the guys who are learning in Lakewood aren't really serious guys. This is what I heard, a rumor, not really serious. You know, they're there because it's a thing to do. So he starts yelling at me. This is Lashon Hara, it's Rechilus, it's this and that. It gives me over the head. And then he says, it's not a third, it's half. Okay, so at least he admitted that. That's what Lakewood is, and this is who Rav Aaron was. But years earlier, there was somebody else on the scene, and his name was Bernard Revel. Bernard Revel was born in Europe as well, in a place very close to Kovna. And Bernard Revel, when he grew up, he was actually in 1905 a revolutionary. You know, there wasn't Soviet government yet. It was before the Soviet Revolution, the Bolsheviks in 1917. But there were attempts to topple the Tsar already in 1905. And he was arrested. And when he, as they say, got out of jail, he fled and he went to America. He gets to America, he enrolls in the then Yeshivas Rabbeinu Yitzchak Elchanan. Yeshivat Rabbeinu Yitzchak Elchanan was a school that was founded in New York City in 1896 by migrants from Kovna. Who was the great Rav of Kovna in the late 19th century? Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan Spector. And Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan Spector was the teacher of Dr. Revel's father. And Dr. Revel's father was a Talmud Chacham, he was a local Rav, and was buried next to Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan in the cemetery in Kovna. So obviously he was close to Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan. And the migrants in New York City wanted to memorialize their own very beloved Rebbe, Rav, so they started a yeshiva in New York City. And they called it Yeshivat Rabbeinu Yitzchak Elchanan. Another yeshiva started 10 years earlier called Yeshivat Eitz Chaim in 1886. These two yeshivot by 1910 actually merged under the name Yeshivat Rabbeinu Yitzchak Elchanan. But in the 1908, 1909, he studied in the yeshiva there, but then was invited by a very, very distinguished Rav in Philadelphia, Rav Leventhal, to serve as his, let's call it secretary, assistant rabbi of sorts. And there, he already gets involved in secular education. Dr. Revel received a doctorate in studies that most B'nai Torah never even knew existed, in Karaite studies. Karaites, who knew about the Karaites of the Middle Ages? And to deal with the oral law of the Karaites as opposed to those of Philo of Egypt, of Alexandria, as opposed to the Tzedokim of the days of Chazal, he was at the sectarian groups. He was into writing, doing research on these sectarian groups, as he was continuing to develop as a tremendous Talmud Chacham. And then somebody suggested a shidduch, a young lady from the state of Ohio, whose family were in the oil business in Oklahoma. And Rabbi Revel marries this young lady, and the family brings him into the business. There's a biography written by Rabbi Aaron Rakefet, on the Bernard Revel story. I believe it was even his doctoral thesis at YU. And the cover of the picture, you see Revel with his black kapota and his black kippah and his beard, and behind him an oil rig. I mean, it's a surrealistic picture just to see this. And he worked in the business as he was studying Gemara in Oklahoma. He became personally very wealthy, and the family was very, very rich. Very rich. This becomes important for the continuation. In 1915, a very large philanthropist in New York, Harry Fischel, who was involved in the Yeshivas Rabbeinu Yitzchak Elchanan, invites Dr. Revel to take the helm of the yeshiva. And he becomes the first president of what we call REITS, Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan Theological Seminary. And they start a high school, Talmudic Academy, which the fellows call TA till this very, very day. And that was a chidush. It was a novel idea. A yeshiva with a high school, a secular high school. Because the migration from Eastern Europe that began in the 1880s, everybody was going to public school. And many of them, it didn't take long before they took their Yiddishkeit and threw it away. That was happening. And Revel understood that the only way he's going to will be able to keep Judaism within the fold is to have an American institution that will have American values, that will teach the sciences and the humanities, and Torah. And if we work it together, we're going to come up with a fusion that will be a success story for American Judaism. And it works. The institution begins to grow. It's still located in the Lower East Side of Manhattan, and then makes a very, very big move uptown. Uptown was the German Jewish community. These people were very well-to-do people. It was a really classy neighborhood at the time, Washington Heights. The problem was the Washington Heights German Jewish community was not terribly interested in the influx of Litvaks, of Eastern European Jews. They didn't like Litvaks, and they didn't like Galicianas and Polish Jews. They didn't like them at all. And I can tell you from a family who went to the Breuer's Yeshiva in Washington Heights, they never spoke with any degree of respect of YU of Yeshiva University. They called it the school on the other side of Broadway. That was the most they were able to refer to, Yeshiva University. They never got along, these two communities. But nevertheless, Revel understood that this is a great place to build a yeshiva, and they build a building that exists till this very day on Amsterdam Avenue, the first main building, and they start a college in 1928. And from there, it was only a question of time that the college is going to develop into a university. Now, Dr. Revel did not live to see this because the university status came in the early days of the second president, Rav Dr. Samuel Belkin, Olav Shalom. In 1943, it becomes YU, Yeshiva University, which a college and graduate school programs. And in 54, they had Stern College for the ladies, and then they have the Albert Einstein Medical School in 56, and this school and that school. It became four campuses, and you know that's for YU public relations to talk about. But it becomes a very, very large institution where the core of the institution is still Yeshivat Rabbeinu Yitzchak Elchanan, the yeshiva. And its declared objective is to train rabbis to have smicha. The Rav, Zichron Lebracha, signed 2,000 smichas that Rav taught in the yeshiva for 45 years. From the time his father passed away, very similar time of Dr. Revel's passing, till he himself withdrew from the classroom in 1986, 45 years the man taught, and raised two generations of Rabbanim. There's no small matter. But Revel was not just an administrator. He never gave up the idea of teaching. So his last days as a teacher were very, very tragic. He's teaching Shulchan Aruch Yoredeya, and he has a stroke in the middle of the shir. He lost his vision. He never led on to his Talmidim that he went blind. He continues the shir for another 45 minutes by heart. And he's giving the shir. And nobody realizes what just happened. He had obviously massive hemorrhaging in the brain, and he continues giving the shir. And after the shir, he tells one of the students he has a little bit of a headache, if they can help him home. He dies 3 days later in the hospital. So it was very, very sad that that's how he was taken. But from a financial point of view, Revel was able to secure tremendous amount of monies, number one, from his own family. And when you are a big giver, and you all know this if you're involved in philanthropy, then you can urge other philanthropists to give as well. And it worked. It worked. The original two domes on the building on Amsterdam Avenue was solid gold. Today you go there, it's green paint. What happened to the gold? So what happened was the Depression years in the 1930s. After 29, the stock market collapsed. So Revel felt he still had to pay salaries to the Rosh Yeshiva and to the staff, to the college lecturers and professors. And he just, for 10 years, stripped the gold from the domes on top of the building until life, financial life, improved in the United States. And he was able to go through without missing a payment, which was really sensational. And, you know, here they raised the money for the gold domes. Somebody donated it, and it became salary for a decade to run the yeshiva. I believe that there's a fundamental difference between the way Dr. Revel and Rav Aaron Kotler saw education. Rav Aaron Kotler, as I said, was advocating Torah only. And Dr. Revel was advocating Torah with. And Torah with meant not that we're going to learn Torah part-time, and now we're going to discuss liberal arts. We'll have literature, we'll have math, and we'll have sciences, and whatever the college is going to teach. Dr. Revel believed that the liberal arts and the sciences are an integral part of one's Torah education. That when considering greats like the Rambam and people who were so well versed in the sciences, they never saw their study of what we might call the secular studies as anything secular, but another avenue of trying to appreciate God's created world. This was a philosophy that became part and parcel of what Yeshiva University was all about. Dr. Belkin, Olav Shalom, used the word synthesis all the time, all the time. It could be that they had in their minds something that Shamshon Afal Hirsch already considered in the mid-19th century. I have here a, it's not on your page, but, no, did I have it here? The syllabus, here it is, no. Oh, I do have it on your page, on the second side. Take a look at the second side, number 11. It's the syllabus of Shamshon Farel Hirsch's school of 1853. Look what he has in a school, in a Jewish school in Frankfurt. Hasafivrit, this is from the morning. This is according to the time schedule. The first thing they studied was Hebrew language. The second thing they studied was the German language. One second, what happened to Chumash? What happened to Mishnah? What happened to Gemara? Hold on. First you have to learn language. And you have to learn Hebrew, and you have to learn the local language. Because if you don't have the tools of language, there's no, it's no sense continuing. The next order of the day was Tanakh. So it would be Torah, Nevi'im, Ketuvim, with all the various commentaries. The next order of the day was the natural sciences. The natural sciences. And the next, after that came history. And after that came what he called Mada HaChayim, life sciences. And there he meant mitzvot. All right, now we're going to talk about what the mitzvot are, whether the written law, the oral law, that there the Torah came into play. It's number 6 on the agenda. The boy or girl was already at 1:30 in the afternoon by the time they got to anything quote-unquote Jewish in this sense. And afterwards, there was writing and arithmetic. Ktiva v'cheshbon. That was his schedule. And Rav Shamshon Farel Hirsch actually had young women integrated into the school. So we have given an awful lot of credit to Sara Schnera, who founded the Beit Yaakov in Krakow in 1916, with the blessings of two great Torah luminaries, one from the Lithuanian side, the Chofetz Chaim, and one the Hasidic side, the Rebbe of Gur. And that was very smart of her to get haskamot, approbations from both of them, and it took off as a very successful endeavor. But the truth is, Sara Schnera, she founded the first institution for Torah study for women in Eastern Europe. But Shamshon Farel Hirsch already was doing it at least 50, 60 years earlier. So I'm just going to read something that was written in German but translated to English by Sara Schnera's successor. She dies in 1934, buried in Krakow, and her successor's name was Dr. Leo Deutschlander. And he writes in a Shamshon Farel Hirsch Society journal about the inner development of this unique woman. He's going to write about Sara Schnera. No spiritual and intellectual force compared to the influence of the writings of Shamshon Farel Hirsch on the self-education and in the development of the personality of Sara Schnera. Before I saw this, I never knew this. I never knew that Sara Schnera was so influenced by Shamshon Farel Hirsch. And he goes on to write that the most popular subject matter that Sara Schnera taught were the 19 letters of Hirsch. And he writes here, hundreds of essays from collected writings of Hirsch were copied again and again and distributed in stencil form. Do you remember stencils? Remember, you know, the mimeographing? That was ready. Mimeographing was ready the next generation. Stencil. They had stencils in 1934 in Germany amongst the Beis Yaakov girls. No other books in the Beis Yaakov library were used so often as the writings of Shamshon Farel Hirsch. And there's no question that she saw that the young ladies had to study Torah. And her only mission would be to get the approval of the Rabbonim in Eastern Europe, in Poland, to let this happen. And she indeed succeeded. This idea of Torah only as opposed to Torah with takes us back to the days of our Chazal. So if you look at the source page, in source number 3, so you have, I lifted out of Rabbeinu Google Shlita. You heard of him? Rabbeinu Google Shlita, right? Of Wikipedia in Hebrew. A few lines about Bernard Revel and Rav Aaron Kotler. But in source number 3, we just read this morning. Vayigdalu hane'arim, and the twins, that the young, they grew up. We're talking about Yaakov and Esav. They grew up. Vayi Esav ish yudei atzayid ish sadeh. So he was a man of the field, a hunter, man of the field, man who could provide for food on the table. V'Yaakov ishtam yoshev olim. Yaakov was in the tents. What does it mean he was in the tents? So Rashi in source number 4 says he was studying. Rashi says, Ohalo shel shem ve'ohalo shel ever is a concept, a midrasha concept of a early yeshiva called the Yeshiva of Shem Ve'eva. Again, I don't know the address. I don't know if it had a dorm. I don't know if it had a kitchen. I don't know who how they studied there. But it's an idea that Chazal say that there were scholars who sat and discussed their ideas, and Yaakov was part of that movement, Yoshev Ohalim, which means that Yaakov did not have anything to do with the field. And you know, when you say in English, what profession are you in? What field are you in? And that's because it comes from Sadeh. Because that's where people earned their livelihood. They were farmers. So then it expanded. Now you're in high tech. So your high tech is your field, your profession. So Esav was a professional, and Yaakov was a student of Torah, a Torah-only person, not mixing anything into it. And then the parasha continues. And Rivka catches wind that Yitzchak wants to give a bracha to Esav. And Rivka understands that this is not a good idea at all, and that Yaakov should receive the brachot. And she has to doctor this up. So Yaakov says, one second, Esav is a very hairy person. Although Yitzchak is blind, but he may tap me on the arm and see that I'm chalak. So I once thought that chalak meant a smooth suit, you know, chalak. No, that it's not hairy wool. But chalak, that's what it means in the Chumash. But today when you go to a store and they tell you it's glatt in America, that means that it had shotness testing already beforehand. But Yaakov was worried about this. And what Rivka does is dresses him up, camouflages him as Esav. Puts on a costume. He's costumed as Esav in terms of gloves, in terms of arm, in terms of beged garment, and he goes in. And in source number 5, Vayigash Yaakov el Yitzchak aviv vayimushehu. And indeed, Yitzchak, who's blind, is tapping this son. And he says, Vayomer, Hakol kol Yaakov vayadayim yidei Esav. Sounds like Yaakov, feels like Esav. Velo hi kiro, couldn't recognize him. Ki hayu yadav, because his hands were as hairy as his brother Esav. And Yitzchak remembered that Yaakov was not such a hairy person. And he gives him the bracha. The standard understanding is that Vayavarcheyu, okay, he's convinced it's Esav. So he sounds like Yaakov. I don't exactly get it. He's still confused. It's clearly Yitzchak is confused. But he thinks it's Esav, feels like Esav, he must be Esav, let's give him the bracha. Or something very different. Yitzchak understood that it's either Torah with, only Torah only, or nothing. It's either this or that. You're either a Yaakov or you're an Esav. Yitzchak never could fathom the idea that you could be both. You could be in Yaakov and Esav all in one package. You can be a kol kol Yaakov, radiate and resonate the voice of Yaakov in tefillah, in Torah. And on the other hand, you can be gifted as a man of the field. You can have yadayim, yidei Esav. So the Gemara tells us, there is no tefillah in the world, Jew or non-Jew, that doesn't emanate from the kol kol Yaakov. And there's no warrior in the world, Jew or non-Jew, that does not emanate from the yadayim, yidei Esav. What does that mean? It means that in a Hesder yeshiva, where the boys are yeshiva boys but also serve in the army, they willingly turn and morph into Esavs when they go into the battle. And that's a hard thing to swallow, hard pill to swallow. They're becoming Esavs. And when Rav Aaron Lichtenstein came in Aliyah in 71, he consulted with an individual who he also saw as his Rebbe. Obviously, the Rav was his principal Rebbe, his Rabbi, Rav Muvak. He was the son-in-law of the Rav and everything. But he also saw Rav Yitzhak Hutner, the Rosh Yeshiva of Chaim Berlin, as one of his Rebbeim, because he, Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, studied by the Rosh Yeshiva in Chaim Berlin Yeshiva when he was 12 years old. He was in the Rosh Yeshiva Shir. And they kept a connection. And Rav Hutner told him that the Hesder concept is clearly not Bitul Torah. When the boys go out of the yeshiva into the army, nobody is going to hold them accountable that they're wasting Torah study time. That is completely defensible. why, we understand why they're doing it. The only thing Rav Huttner advised Rav Aaron to be careful, as a note of caution, that the personality, the character of the yeshiva boy might become tarnished when he's in the army, because he's going to temporarily become an Esav. And you have to make sure when he gets back to the Beit Midrash, he's able to wash his hands from being an Esav. And Rav Lichtenstein took this to heart. And there are many, many things that go on in the yeshiva to inoculate the fellas before they go into the army so that they don't become thoroughbred Esavs at the end of the day. But this is important to know, that this is a new breed. Yitzchak did not recognize it. Lo hikiro. Because to him, if you had the Kol Kol Yaakov, you don't have the Yadayim Yedei Esav. And here, Yaakov has both. And in spite of it all, Vayavarcheyu, he gives a blessing to this new type. So which is the correct type? The type of Yaakov Ishtam Yosheva Oalim? The Yaakov sitting in the yeshiva of Shem Ve'ever, exclusively engaged in Torah study, as Rav Aaron Kotler saw it? Or was it the Revel model of HaKol Kol Yaakov by Yadayim Yedei Esav? You merge with Torah other pursuits. And the pursuits can be academic. In the Hesder Yeshiva, they happen to be military. In the Bnei Akiva Torah Va'avodah, it's work on the field. It's Esav work on the field. Whatever it is, it's Torah with a Vavachibur, with a conjunction and, something else. Can we say that one is right and one is wrong? Categorically not. We invoke that which Chachamim said, Elu ve'elu devrei Elokim chayim. They're both Torah. And the critical moment or factor has to be circumstance. There are certain historic circumstances, and there are certain circumstances that are relevant to the individual that will put the person in this camp as opposed to the other camp. And that has to be respected. It has to be respected. Let's take the scenario in Eretz Yisrael. It was the Chazon Ish, Zatzal, 1949, an historic meeting with Ben-Gurion. And that's where they negotiated certain things, what's known as the status quo of religious life in Israel. And one of the things on the agenda was that the Chazon Ish asked for 250 yeshiva boys to be exempt from the army. Why? Because we have to rebuild Torah. Same rationale of Rav Aaron Kotler. And he said, and he asked Ben-Gurion, who not only was prime minister, but also defense minister, can the army, in terms of its military needs, get by without the manpower of 250 fellows who are of age to serve? And Ben-Gurion made a calculation. He said, we can do it. We can do it. So the deal was 250 yeshiva boys won't go to the army. From that deal, snowballed a scenario of political arrangements that now stands at 80,000. 80,000 Israeli 18-year-olds do not go to the army because they're, quote-unquote, sitting and learning. And it's not such a simple issue. It's a very, very powerful, difficult political issue that's on the table right now as we talk, as the government is struggling to put itself together, because one of the issues at hand is the issue of the draft. And there are all kinds of proposals and so on. The Chazon Ish never ever said that there's no need for the army, nor did he ever say that the army is a place that will cause spiritual deterioration of a religious soldier. He felt, he was thinking totally positive, that I need a core of budding Talmidei Chachamim to get the job done for the next generation. Whereas today, what we're hearing in certain circles is that you just don't go to the army because you're going to come out, you know, at worst, not religious, and at best, watered down religiously, and therefore it's just not good. It's not good. The problem is it's a very divisive issue, and I have good news. I have good news that it's changing. And it's not changing because of decisions from above of the spiritual and political religious leadership. It's changing because the guys who are 17, 18-year-olds, they want to go to the army. And they founded a unit in the Israeli army called Netzach Yehuda, which is for Haredi yeshiva boys. And every single year, the induction to Netzach Yehuda quadruples every single year, more and more and more are serving. And I see this as a very, very positive thing, in spite of the fact that I do believe that there are certain Talmidei Chachamim that it would be wise for Klal Yisrael to exempt them from the army. But I don't think it has to be 80,000. And especially when everybody knows that from the 80,000, not everybody is there sitting and learning. Come to Ramat Ashkol, to the bagel store and the pizza shop at 10:30 in the morning, and you'll know exactly what I'm talking about. It's very sad commentary, very sad. But I do believe that which the Chazon Ish and his colleague, the Ponovitch Arov, felt was necessary. And that which Rav Aaron Kotler felt was necessary, was necessary. The time framework was demanded that we have that kind of Torah education. On the other hand, no less important was that which Dr. Revel sponsored and proposed and developed. No less important, perhaps even more important. Because this comes through source number 7. In source number 7, it's the famous dispute between Rabbi Shmuel and Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai. The Torah says, in Yehoshua, Perek Aleph, it says, Lo yamush sefer Torah mipicha vehagita bo yam v'layla. Do not leave the sefer Torah. Engage in its study day and night. And the Gemara says, Rabbi Shmuel says, what do you mean? You can't do that. You have to work on the field. And you have to do what everybody's doing. That's how you're going to live. And Rabbi Shmuel says, Han heg bahen minhag derech eretz. You have to conduct yourself the way the people, normal, civilized people, conduct themselves. They go to work, and you have to go to work. And you have to have time during your day for Torah study. That's his proposal. Shimon bar Yochai says, when are they going to study Torah? They're going to be busy on the field throughout the year. And therefore, he says that if somebody is engaged in Torah study full-time, the work's going to get done by others. He doesn't clarify who are the others, but he says, Melachtan naseit aydei acherim, it's going to get done. What's interesting, that this Gemara brings it to some type of conclusion. It says those who followed the first opinion, Rabbi Shmuel, were successful. And the commentators say, successful in both their Torah study and in their financial dealings, because they earned a living. And those who followed Reb Shimon bar Yochai were failures. They had nothing to eat. They were starving. And they also didn't have Torah study because they were worried where the next meal is going to come from. So it was a failure, says the Gemara. The Gemara says this, it was a failure. So the Chatam Sofer, who lived 150 years ago in Prezburg, today it's called Bratislava, so said, you know why it failed? Because you have to be a Reb Shimon bar Yochai for it to work. You know who Reb Shimon bar Yochai was? In the story of Lag BaOmer, the Kabbalist, the caves, he was on a different frequency, spiritual frequency, than anybody else. Reb Shimon bar Yochai dies on the 18th of Iyar, which is Lag BaOmer. According to the Chatam Sofer, that was the day that man began to fall from heaven in the desert. If you can live a life expecting man to fall, as Reb Shimon bar Yochai, then you can live that kind of existence. But if you're not there, if you're not at the level of Reb Shimon bar Yochai, says the Gemara, don't dare live that kind of existence. So the Chatam Sofer, he takes a stand and explains, yes, there is room, there's legitimacy for Reb Shimon bar Yochai, but you have to be Reb Shimon bar Yochai. You have to be at that level. And it's not for everybody. It's meant for what we call Yechidei Sgula. It's very, very select individuals, and they can actually live up to this. Shamshon Fal Hirsch was clearly in the camp of what we're now identifying as Revel, without a doubt. But Shamshon Fal Hirsch, in this week's parsha, in Toldot, says that he's looking ahead to Parshat Vayechi. He says, why didn't Yaakov Avinu give his sons one bracha? They should all be successful koilel boys and learn in a yeshiva. Why didn't he say that? What does he do? He takes each son, representing now each tribe, each future tribe, and he assigns them a task. and you're going to be in farming, and you're going to be in international commerce, sailing, shipping, like Zvulun, and you're going to be doing this, and you're going to be doing that, because Shamshon Folher says that's how you make a state. You obviously have to have a Shevet, and it's Shevet Levi, that's going to be involved in education. Yoru Mishpatecha LeYakov LeTorahcha LeYisrael. That's why they never received a plot of land in Eretz Yisrael, but rather 48 cities from north to south, and they were the teachers. They were the education staff of Am Yisrael. They were the ones engaged in Torah study. They were the ones who served in the Beit HaMikdash. That's what Levi. But everybody else was doing something, and they had to do something. On the second side, if you look at the beginning of the paragraph, by five lines down from the second side, Kasha nikbitzu b'nei Yaakov l'shmoet birkat avihem, when the sons of Yaakov joined to hear the blessings of their father, v'halo ra'a b'hem et shiftei Yisrael shel atid. Yaakov Avinu is not looking at 12 sons, he's looking at the future, the tribes of Am Yisrael. Lo ra'a rak kohanim u'morei hora'a. He didn't just see rabbonim and kohanim. He didn't see that. Hine amad sham shevet halevia, v'shevet hamelucha, v'shevet hasocharim, v'shevet haikarim, v'shevet halochamim. He saw there a tribe that was politically inclined to assume the monarchy. He saw a tribe that would be involved in commerce. He saw a tribe that would be involved in agriculture. He saw a tribe that would be warriors. This is what he saw. And he says, amad sham leneged enav ha'am kulo. He's looking at the entire nation with all its multifaceted virtues and how it's going to develop. And he says, ish ish asher ki birkato berach otam in Parshat Vayechi. Each tribe received an appropriate blessing that would be earmarked for the appropriate task of the tribe. And he says, ki brit Hashem hakrucha im Avraham, the covenant that was signed with Avraham Avinu, chafetza bi'uma b'riya shlema v'ranana, was interested in a nation that would be healthy, would be complete, and would be invigorated with things fresh, with invigoration. This is what he saw, Sham Shafal Hirsch. It's interesting that Hirsch was an anti-Zionist. That's a speech in itself. And what he says in Parshat Bechukotai, and why he rejects the early Zionists of the 19th century, because he thought that the way he understood the progression of Jewish history, we weren't there yet. And he turns his back to it, even though Rav Kalischer, who was one of the great early religious Zionist spokesmen, turned to Rav Hirsch in a letter and thought that we can do business. Here's a man who recognized the world. Here's a man who's pro secular education. Here's a man who's into sciences and culture and arts. This is a man who's obviously going to join the bandwagon of the Shivat Zion movement. And Hirsch turns his back on it because he didn't think that Am Yisrael was ready for it in the way he understood how history would ultimately unfold. Unfortunately, the Shoah proved him wrong in the way he understood history. He was a great believer in German culture. And we know what German culture ultimately turned out to, the greatest monster in history. But nevertheless, Shamshon Fal Hirsch had some great ideas. And in the pasuk that we say in Shabbat, in the Shir Shal Yom, in Mizmor Shel Yom HaShabbat, in source number 9, Tzadik Katamar Yifrach Ke'erez Balvanon Yiskeh. The tzadik is compared to the palm, the date palm, and is also compared to the cedar tree from Lebanon. Shtulim bevet Hashem bechatzrot Elokeinu yafrichu. They will be planted in the yard of the Beit HaMikdash, but the fruits will actually blossom outside. And Hirsch, in his commentary to Tillim, says an unbelievable idea. He says that the tamar, I'll read it inside in source 10, the tamar gives fruit. The date gives fruit. The date palm gives fruit. It dates. But it does not have the strength to stand up to strong winds. It's not a strong plant. Whereas the erez, the cedar from Lebanon, very, very strong, but it does not give fruit. And therefore, the tzaddik will have the virtues of both. will have students who will be the fruits and will also be very, very strong on his own. The planting of the tzaddik is in the Beit Hashem. That's where it takes place. But that's where the roots are. But the blossoming, the flowers, is outside the Beit Midrash. B'chatzrot Elokeinu yafrichu. The point isn't to be confined in your Beit Midrash. Those of you who visited Poland and have gone to Lublin have seen the remarkable Beit Midrash building that was constructed by Rav Meir Shapiro. He was the Rav of Lublin and also the Rosh Yeshiva of the Chachmi Lublin Yeshiva. In 1923, at the Aguda Convention in Vienna, he suggests the idea of Daf Yomi. We're coming next month to the culmination of the 13th cycle of the Daf Yomi, a page a day. He never thought that there are going to be women studying Daf Yomi. He never, in his wildest dreams, thought that. But he was hoping that if two Jews, total strangers, meet up on the train, instead of talking about the politics or the weather, we'll talk about the page of Gemara that they studied together. An edifice was constructed as a Beit Midrash, and it was opened up in 1930. One of the guests at the ceremony was Zeb Jabotinsky. And he tells Rav Meir Shapiro, it's a wonderful binyan, wonderful, wonderful building. There's only one problem. Here in Lublin, it's not going to last for long. Because Jabotinsky was already telling the world that Am Yisrael in Europe was doomed, doomed. He was the only one who really saw it. And he cried to people, and they laughed him off the stage. The Lublin yeshiva ended 9 years later. 9 years. And they raised tons of money to build it. And it really was an edifice. And it's visitable today again. But unfortunately, on the facing of the Beit Midrash, as was then, and it's in its reconstructed stage now, it was a pasuk from Tehillim, L'chu vanim yirat Hashem, and they asked Rav Meir Shapiro, L'chu vanim means go out. Why don't you have a pasuk that suggests come in, inviting people to come in? And he said, we don't want our talmidim to stay inside. We want them to go outside and spread Torah. That's the message of the yeshiva. When you finish with the yeshiva, l'chu vanim, go out and spread the word. And my successor at Chashmonaim, who took over as Rosh Yeshiva in 2006, he was so impressed with that pasuk in Lublin that we finally finished our Beit Midrash, put up the same pasuk of Chachmi Lublin from Tilim, l'chu vanim yirat Hashem. And those yeshivot in Europe were clearly Torah only. And this was the model of Rav Aaron Kotler and so on. And I say again, they did a great service for Klal Yisrael, and they're still continuing to do a service for Klal Yisrael. And no less so, Bernard Revel's understanding, and those who've followed, you know, that point of view, which is mainstream, both in North America and in Eretz Yisrael, within whether it's B'nai Akiva movement or other streams of yeshiva high schools. And then even today, a student going to Bar Ilan University, where it's clearly not yeshiva university, although that was the original intention in 1954. When Dr. Pinchas Churgin left the YU in 54 to start Bar Ilan, it was supposed to become a yeshiva university. And a luminary was contacted, the Sri Deyesh, Rabbi Chiyo Yaakov Weinberg, to serve as its first Rosh Yeshiva. But none of that happened. And it turned out to be a university with a Judaic studies program. Only in the 1970s was a Kollel component added onto Bar Ilan. So now a fellow or a girl, young lady, can study in the Midrashah and have that kind of Torah Umada, Torah and science experience in Bar Ilan, which I think is very, very encouraging. And Yeshiva University continues the message of Dr. Revel. When I talk about yeshivot and chutz laretz, I always remember the Gemara in Masechet Megillah that says, Atidin batei knesiot ubatei midrashot shebabavel lalot l'Eretz Yisrael. Ultimately, all the shuls and all the yeshivas of Bavel, and it's not just Babylon, it's the diaspora, they're going to make it to Eretz Yisrael. It's only a question of time. So I'll end with just one little idea of Rabbi Beryl Wine. Rabbi Beryl Wine, who now is sitting in Yerushalayim for a few good years already, was a rabbi and Rosh Yeshiva in Muncie, New York, and they were building a new Beis Medrash, and they were wood frame buildings. He gets a price quote from one contractor who's willing to guarantee the wood for 90 years. Then he gets another quote from another contractor who's willing to guarantee the wood for 450 years. So Rabbi Wein says, we'll take the first guy. He says, why? The second one's going to guarantee the wood for 450 years. And Rabbi Wein says, I don't want any Jews left in Muncie in 450 years. It's bad enough, he said, that they're going to be here in 90 years. That's what he said. That was good. I like that. It's a very, very healthy attitude. And the truth of the matter is, that Baruch Hashem, I am encouraged that here, all I've heard about in the various places that times that I've spoken and talked to people, everybody's got family in Eretz Yisrael. I mean, I know that. I, my shul, I have people from Toronto, from your communities here. Eretz Yisrael is really on the minds, the hearts and souls of everybody in this community. And most probably, all of you certainly merit that which Rav Kook wrote when he was in London during World War I. He went to Switzerland. He was stuck in Europe during World War I. And he said, those who live and breathe Eretz Yisrael while in Chutz Laretz, zocheh lekama v'kama skulot sheb Eretz Yisrael, will be worthy of some of the merits of Eretz Yisrael. He does not delineate, but it just sounded good. It sounded very, very good. My father, Olav Shalom, was such a person. And while before they came in Aliyah in 93, he already began saying Talu Matal Levracha on the 7th of Cheshvan, not in Barech Aleinu, but in the Brach of Shema Koleinu, where there's an allowance to say whatever you want to say. And he did that in identification with the Tefillah for Geshem in Eretz Yisrael. So this week, everybody's going to join forces with Am Yisrael in Eretz Yisrael on December 5th. That's a shear in itself, why it's December 5th. And we do need the rain, by the way. We need it. Although we do have desalinization plants, and it's not as critical as it used to be. But nevertheless, we need a few good storms, and hopefully we'll get it before the end of the winter. You're all cordially invited to visit, and hope to see you there as soon as possible. Thank you. Kol tov.
So
high.
Yes.
What was his attitude to the Zionist agenda?
He was anti-Zionist. Rav Aaron Kotler was far from, he was not apolitical. He was not apolitical at all. He did not see favor in the Zionist enterprise. He did visit Eretz Yisrael often enough because he assumed the title of Rosh Yeshiva of the Eitz Chaim Yeshiva in Yerushalayim after his father-in-law, Rav Zalman Meltzer, passed away, and he would come occasionally to show his face. That's true. He did have a connection to the yeshiva, but he was not involved at all. However, Rav Zalman Meltzer had a son, a Rav Meltzer, who became the principal of a yeshivat HaDarom near Rehovot. And that's a very Zionist institution, supported by the RCA, by the way, whose son-in-law, who had a daughter, who married Rav Amital, right? And I can tell you a very interesting piece of, let's call it Rechilus in the family. It's a very nice story. Rav Aaron Kotler was succeeded by his son, Rav Shneur Kotler. Rav Shneur Kotler was succeeded by his son, Malkiel Kotler. One of the grandchildren, well, let's just use the word for lack of better term, was off the derech, right? That's a phrase that's used, on some level, off the derech. And the Kotlers were very embarrassed. I mean, this is the family of Rav Aaron Kotler. Hey, you can't have a grandson, floating around. Something has to be done. And an idea came up that they have this mishpacha in Alon Shvut, Rav Amital, the Rosh Yeshiva of Yeshiva Taretzion, the co-Rosh Yeshiva with Rav Lichtenstein, and maybe they'll send this Kotler, Junior Kotler, and Rav Amital is going to straighten him out. And Rav Amital accepted the challenge, And I know the American who was assigned to him to keep an eye on him and watch him. And he was then repackaged and sent back to Lakewood as a mensch. And he didn't become a big Talmud Chacham in the sense of one of the Rosh Yeshiva, but they were indebted to the Amitals. Rav Amital's wife, Tibadel Lor Chaim Tovim, granddaughter of Rabbi Zalman Meltzer, and she was a cousin of Rabbi Aaron Kotler, and they took care of this boy. Where was Revel? Revel had died already, 1940, so he wasn't there. He was active in Agudas HaRabbonim. You did not have a strong Mizrahi yet in the 30s and 40s. I'm sorry? He was not an anti-Zionist polemicist at all. Quite the contrary. The yeshiva, as far as I know, was identified on some level, I don't know, organizationally, but certainly was not anti-Zionist. The yeshivas Rabbeinu Yitzchak Chanan never, ever was associated at any stage with anti-Zionism. Whereas Rabbi Aaron Kotler, it was riding the Aguda, you know, standard line. And that line before the war, before World War II, was fundamentally no different than the Satmar Rebbe, that there's no need for an independent Jewish state before the coming of Mashiach. The only thing is that after the state was established, so the Aguda read the historic map differently and said, all right, we have to cooperate on some level. They still do not recognize, they accept the state, what they call de facto, but not fully. There's no Israeli flag in Aguda institutions, there's no Atikva, there's no Yom HaTzmut. As everybody says publicly and now privately and publicly, and on the Zionist issue, there's no difference between the Palestinians and the Aguda. No difference whatsoever. Lieberman, the candidate Lieberman, says it now very openly. And it caused a lot of resentment. But the truth is, there's really no difference. Lieberman, Avigdor Lieberman, yeah. Okay, so that's an impossible question because they're not here. But, you know, you're asking for a speculative type of response. I think each of them would say that they succeeded. I think Rav Aaron Kotler would say that he succeeded royally. And because Lakewood not only became 6,500 Talmidim, Lakewood became tentacles. There are Lakewood offshoots now. There are kolalim of Lakewood all over the United States. In states that never had a minyan, that have Shomer Shabbos. What was that?
And Canada.
What was that? Some of Venera. Yeah. And Dr. Revel, I'm sure, would be very proud of how things developed. That doesn't mean that on a particular issue, you know, Dr. Revel may not have seen favor with something going on at YU today, for example. But that's irrelevant. You're talking about the big issue. You know, how this developed. Yeah. Personality. So Rav Aaron Kotler was, you know what, there's a common thread. They were both lions. They were lions. The Rav told me once, Rav Salvezhik told me that Revel's mind was wild, which wasn't actually a compliment if you understand where Rav Salvezhik was coming from. Those who studied from Volozhin and Brisk, they were disciplined. Their minds were very, very disciplined. They had things worked out by definitions. Revel was, like we call, all over the place. He was just using sources here and there and there. In Yiddish, it's called varfing, throwing sources and just wild. Rav Aaron Kotler was, I wouldn't say he was a calm individual. I wouldn't say that at all. He was a zealot to a certain degree. But he believed in what he went out on a limb to do things that he believed in. Like, for example, with regard to Torah and Eretz Yisrael. So he leaves the Eretz Yisrael. He goes to the United States, but he gets involved in this network called Chinuch Atzma'i, independent Chinuch. Because the way it works in Israel is you have the public school system And then there's the religious public school system, Mamlachti, Mamlachti Dati. And then there are private schools, like B'nai Akiva is a private school, and other private schools. But then there's actually a third track. It's called Chinuch Atzma'i, independent. So the question is it funded by the government or not? The answer is partially, more substantially now than ever before. But at the beginning, it was partial. And they had to do an awful lot of fundraising to get this together. So Rav Aaron Kotler and Rav Moshe Feinstein were the co-presidents. And they did something very bold. They invited Rav Soloveitchik, the Rav, to serve on this presidium. And the Rav does it the same year that he gives the unbelievable manifesto on religious Zionism at YU on Yom HaTzma'ut, Kol Dodi Dofek. And the Rav was clearly in the religious Zionist camp, and Rav Aaron Kotler realizes that the Rav can open up doors to potential donors that they, Rav Aaron and Rav Moshe Feinstein, could not. And the Rav would do it because he believed in the spreading of Torah. So I actually asked the Rav once, so how did you feel about this? I mean, the Chinuch Atzma'i was not the our yeshivot, or our style yeshivot. He said, they're Yiddisha Kinderlach, they're Jewish children, they have to study Torah. And if I can do anything to help them, so I will help Rav Aaron Kotler. And it just so happens that the two of them, Rav Aaron Kotler and the Rav, were in communication on all kinds of public issues. And there were sometimes heated debates between the two of them over the phone. People have reported. Rabbi Rakefet once in the apartment, and he heard a heated debate with a discussion with Rabbi Aaron Kotler. So they dealt with public issues and so on. So he was a heated individual, very, very much so. Yeah. Right, right.
There must be some record that I would have dealt with
it. First of all, I'm not familiar if there's any record about this, but he was working with an understanding of what they call in the halakha, hora'at sha'ah. It's an emergency situation. After the Shoah, we have to put all the other considerations on the side, and we have to rebuild Torah as quickly and efficiently as possible. And that would override all the other considerations. And there will be others who will make a living, and hopefully these fellows will have what to eat.
So in other words, if it's transitory, the time will come when that no longer has to be.
Right, but he never set down whether we're talking about 10 years, 50 years, 1,000 years, because as we speak, it hasn't changed. This idea, the lake, it's just growing. Doesn't apply today.
For, I'm sure, for the
yep, right.
So, you know, it's like,
right.
That's more kind of point.
Right.
Right.
Yeah. I'm not an expert in the Pachad Yitzchak of this forum of all his teachings, but I can tell you that Rav Hutna is an extremely complex personality that went through, he himself morphed several times over. In the 19-teens, he was a very, very close friend of the Soloveitchiks, the Rav's parents, when they came from Belarus to Warsaw. They fled during World War I, and they ended up in Warsaw. And he was very, very close to them, so much so that in 1928, when the Rav's father was invited by Revel to come to New York and serve as the top shiur at the yeshiva, he still did not bring his family. You know, that was pretty common. The breadwinner would go and get set up and then bring the family. So the Rav's mother and the children were still in Warsaw. And Rav Aaron Soloveitchik, the Rav's youngest brother, was bar mitzvah in the absence of his father, and Rav Hutna prepared him for the bar mitzvah. So this is what we know. And that was the reason that when Rav Aaron Soloveitchik becomes of age, Rav Hutna gives him a job to teach at the Chaim Berlin Yeshiva. And it's interesting, that relationship. In the late 20s, in the 1926-27, Rav Hutner is actually in Berlin with the Rav studying philosophy in the University of Berlin. And there was another very, very important individual at the time, Menachem Mendel Schneerson, who was then the son-in-law of the Lubavitcher Rebbe. He was there. The three of them were there at the time. And the Rav told me that Rachmanis on the lecturers, that if you would have these kind of students in your lecture hall, you'd panic. And and I'll tell you something interesting that Rabbi Rakefa told me, that from the three of them, you know, in Germany it was very common for religious people not to wear kippot, yarmulke, in a house. They wore it if they davened, and they wore it when they ate, because they were brachot. That's really why they wore kippot. But outside they wore hats. That was pretty common as well. All kinds of hats, you know, popular hats. And inside, at work time, they did not wear kippot. And you see this still to this very day. That the fact that somebody's working without a kippah does not make the person not religious at all, because there were different communities that had this. At the university in Berlin, it was very, very common that nobody wore kippot. Nobody, everybody, you took off your hat when you're inside. So you have these three. Two out of three sat in the lecture halls without a kippah. One wore a kippah. Who was the one? Rabbi Rakefa threw this at me, and but it was the Lubavitcher. Right, the Lubavitcher didn't take off his kippah. But Rav Hutner and the Rav did, out of respect for the minhag of the place. It was interesting, I thought. And then Rav Hutner, in 1927, 28, he comes to Eretz Yisrael and he studies by Rav Kook. Becomes a Talmud of Rav Kook. This is Rav Hutner. And then by 1947 in Brooklyn, after having a picture of Rav Kook in his sukkah, he removes it. He's no longer associated with Rav Kook. And he becomes vehemently, vehemently aguda. I mean, he's moving from religious Zionism to very, very much anti-Zionism of the day. But to his credit, I heard somebody tell me that Rav Hutner gave a talk at the yeshiva, in Chaim Berlin Yeshiva in Brooklyn, where he took a subject that Rav Kook developed in one of his books called Orot HaKodesh, and he like reworked it a little bit. You can do that. You know, you can take somebody's material and you make it your own a little bit. You convert it. And he was very proud after the sicha how he took an Orot HaKodesh of Rav Kook and worked it out on his own. He was very proud of it, which means he was still reading it, or he remembered it, and it was still important to him, that which Rav Kook was saying, even though publicly he was not there at all. There was a hesped, a eulogy that Rav Lichtenstein delivered for Rav Hutner in the Beit Midrash. Rav Hutner got some bad press, by the way. Do you remember there was a hijacking that went in 1971, I believe, it went to Jordan. It was sitting in the desert there in Jordan, and they had no electricity. And it was a very, very serious situation. And food supplies and water were running out. Rav Hutner was on that plane. Ultimately, because of a lot of negotiations, they were let out, but without their belongings. One of the things that Rav Hutner was not allowed to take, I mean, he couldn't take anything, but one thing he had there in his suitcase was a draft of the next volume of a Sefer Pachad Yitzchak. So you imagine you write a sefer, you have it in your suitcase, you're on the way back to the States, and it's now confiscated by the Jordanian authorities. And many, many attempts were used to get King Hussein to just be a mensch and let the man have his sefer back. And he was a real manuvel. He didn't do it. He didn't allow it. And Rav Hutner dies without this sefer. In 1994, when Israel and Jordan signed a peace treaty, and Rabin, Olav HaShalom, was there, and Hussein was there, as a gesture, Hussein gives Prime Minister Rabin Rav Hutner's sefer, the last volume of the Pachad Yitzchak. I mean, why couldn't you do it when Rav Huttner was still alive. But at that, I know somebody was on that plane, and there was a big issue about who gets the food first. And he claimed, based on a Gemara in Masechet Horiot, that a Talmud Chacham gets the first food. It didn't go over well with people. It just didn't go over well. I mean, he had his halachic right to say what he was saying, but people didn't take well to it. But this became a big issue in some of Rav Aaron Kotler's activities in the 1940s of the Var Hatzolah. What Rav Aaron Kotler got involved when he was here already in the States, in this organization to save people, survivors, to try to get out. Who are they trying to get out? The yeshiva families, the yeshiva world. And there was a lot of criticism about the Var Hatzolah. What about the others? And the feeling was, let others take care of the others. We're close to the yeshiva world, so we want to save the yeshiva world. And that's what, so a lot of people didn't take well to that either in terms of saving. And, you know, you can make a halakhic case that that was the proper thing to do, but on a public level, it was a little bit problematic. What? The one who spoke about this was this Dr. Esther Farbstein in her book. She deals with it. She deals with it. Oh, the fifth volume. Yeah, yeah. The last, posthumously, obviously. Yeah, yeah. That was published. No doubt. That was published. But I said, Rav Aaron Kotler was involved in this Var Hatzolah, and this became an issue of who's, you know, who gets the right, for sure. Dr. Belkin, Oliver Shalom from YU, was able to save the family of the Chofetz Chaim's family, Rav Mendel Zaks and his wife, and she was the daughter of the Chofetz Chaim. Dr. Belkin received smicha from the Chofetz Chaim at age 17 in Raden. So he had a personal connection with Rav Mendel Zaks and used his influence to get the family out. You know, that's called protexia, that's all. Some people were at mazel and they knew the right people, that's all. Okay, Meseda. Okay.